Welcome, everybody. You are listening to No Coast Cinema here on WGM Plus, WGM Plus's premiere films podcast. I am your host. Little fanfare there. That is the unofficial sub theme song.
Yeah.
So we've got the theme and we've got the sub theme song. I am your host, Tom Hush, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Connor Cornelius.
Hello, Tom. Love you. Best friend. Right.
But I also hate you.
Oh.
So I love you so much that I hate you.
So we've got like a frenemies situation going on.
Yeah, I feel like Gore Vidal and William F. Buckley Jr.
See, there's a reference I definitely get.
Yeah, we're going deep on the political references today. But let's get back to movies. That's what we're talking about here. And right now we're going to do our coming soon segment. So this is a segment where we like to talk about what's happening in the business of film here in the United States and around the world, because film is a global art and it happens everywhere. The first big thing on the docket is going to be the WGA, the Writers Guild of America, and they recently came to an important agreement that avoided some very bad stuff for the industry. Connor, give us a little bit of background on what's happening with the Writers Guild.
So the Writers Guild of America deals with the people who write for television and film.
Mm-hmm.
And they threatened to go on strike if they didn't reach some sort of increase in their basic wage, in their just their basic benefit package that they get while working for these studios. And what that would have looked like if you work in television and film, you've obviously heard about this. This would have resulted in no more content being generated for the upcoming seasons of television.
Now, that would not include anything that was already in production.
Of course.
But the last time this happened was about in the mid-2000s. And they did actually strike. There was a writer strike, if you can remember way back when. I know I was watching Lost at the time. And I think we all saw
what happened with that.
Yeah. The writers went on strike. All the late night shows had to go into reruns and everything. The writers were not writing unless something was already in production. But it seems we have avoided that. Correct, Connor?
Yeah. The people are no longer going to strike. The WGA with the press, revealed that they got a deal that was actually $130 million better than the agreement that it would have gotten had it accepted the deal that was modeled after the Directors Guild of America deal, which was passed a couple of months ago.
Right.
And that does raise some interesting concerns for the Directors Guild of America.
Yeah.
But the WGA is definitely better off for it. I think the main points that we're going to be touching on here, the big three that we could pull out, because the actual specifics of the deal are not have not been revealed to the public yet.
Correct. There are some numbers out there, and we do have a report from the Hollywood Reporter telling us that. But largely, some of it is kept obscured. It's like, you know, they don't want to let everybody know the super fine details, but they do speak to a few of the main ones. First, and this is coming from the report from the Hollywood Reporter, are basic wage increases. So they're saying that they're believed to be nominally 3% per year. This is an increase of 3% per year, as with the Directors Guild of America deal that concluded several months ago. So per year, we're looking at, for writers, at least a 3% increase in basic wages, which is good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they people think, when they think you're working in Hollywood, oh, you're rolling in money, right? You know, you're Steven Spielberg or you're all these guys. But really, this is for writers who are, you know, on the ground trying to just do their thing. They need those wages.
Exactly. It takes about 2 weeks to write an episode for a television show, and you've got a whole room of writers that are working on that. And where if you're working in film, you're writing your own movies, you're getting a little bit of bigger slice of that pie. But if you're, you know, in a regular, more of a normal organization for that, you're not getting nearly as much money as most people would think.
Exactly. So those increases are going to be good. Those are going to be pretty good. Another big point of this was the health plan. So the Writers Guild of America, being part of that, gets you, you know, there's a basic health plan that you can get with them. And
it was a bit of a contentious point.
Yeah.
That was definitely one of the reasons that they were threatening that strike.
Because, you know, you got to have health care. You got to have health care.
As you can see in the modern political climate, a lot of people pissed off about that.
Yeah, you got to have the health care.
If you need any indication that people need health care, just turn on the news.
Exactly. So this is a very timely sort of thing for the Writers Guild. So they got their increase in wages, and the companies are currently infusing additional monies into the health plan for a total of just under $90 million. But that sounds pretty good. That sounds really good, actually.
But what does it actually mean?
Yeah, exactly. There is a caveat to that. The union, the Writers Guild of America, in turn, has agreed to make $7 million in cost savings. So that is going to result in possibly reduced benefits, possibly increased premiums, tightened eligibility, or any combination of those things. The decision has not been made about what those cost savings are going to be, but who knows? You know, if the $90 million could be nice, but if you're losing $7 million in cost savings that are going to reducing benefits for writers,
making them pay more,
increasing the premiums, or you know, tightening the eligibility, we could see a loss perhaps of health care coverage for those writers, which, you know, they could be getting more money into the actual health care, but losing the health care themselves if they're not quite eligible for that plan.
And something that I did see here, which is where the WGA agreement actually diverged from the Directors Guild of America agreement that was reached. The DGA agreed to having a single diversion of pay. Mm-hmm. So towards your pension, of course. Mm-hmm. However, the WGA plan has now agreed to three diversions of the income. So that means that they will be inputting income also towards your pension, also towards your 401k. You know, again, here is an example of the numbers that we don't exactly have not been necessarily released to the public yet. However, this is obviously an improvement over the deal that the DGA struck a couple months back.
Sure. So do you think that maybe the DGA, renegotiating some of those terms?
They're looking at it. That's what the report definitely is alluding to, for sure.
And then the final thing we want to talk about is with the TV writers. So the Writers Guild Association, or Writers Guild of America. Writers Guild of America. They encapsulate film and television writers. However, a lot of this deal was trying to get better stuff for TV writers. We've seen a massive change in the TV landscape. You know, we've got Netflix. Since the last time that they threatened to strike, we've got Netflix, Hulu, are doing original series, Amazon doing original series. We've seen the rise of these kind of short season shows such as Game of Thrones or anything else on HBO, really, because they're doing less than the original, you know, 22, 23 episodes a season. And that was kind of a problem for the writers because they were signing these agreements where, you know, the season they've signed on to be exclusive, and then they're losing out on the possibility of getting more work. They got a right. They got a right for TV. They got a right for movies. They got to get out there. So what happened is for short season series, companies have agreed that writers will be paid pro rata overages if they work more than 2.4 weeks on an episode. So they're going to get it's almost overtime, sort of. If they're going beyond that original, that 2.4 weeks, which we'll call, you know, call it what, 3 weeks, or we'll round down 2 weeks.
Exactly.
Basically, if they're working more than 2 weeks on an episode, then they're going to get some what are called pro rata overages. The companies wanted to fix this at 2.6. The writers wanted to fix that at exactly 2 weeks. So they found that agreement 2.4. So it's a decimal point. We'll see how much that actually matters when it comes to them. And just for a frame of reference, that short season series has been set at 14 episodes or less. So the companies wanted to set that at 12, the writers at 16, and they came out to 14. And the whole idea of the concept of span and the related overages to that span is completely new to the WGA's collective bargaining agreement.
Mm-hmm.
So we've seen some pretty big changes for the Writers Guild. We'll see how it works out for them going forward.
Yeah, and hopefully the DGA takes a second look at that deal.
Exactly. We don't want to get into too much trouble with the DGA. Next, speaking of writers, let's talk about the writer and director, Jordan Peele. He recently signed an agreement with Universal Pictures. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so Jordan Peele recently signed a first look deal with Universal Pictures, as Tom mentioned. For those of you who don't know what a first look deal is, it's essentially a contract which has a clause in there that gives a specified party the right to have the a preemption right to, you know, the right to accept, the right to co-produce, the right to essentially, as the name would suggest, take a first look at some new intellectual property.
Exactly. And this is Jordan Peele, who did the fantastic film Get Out. It was it was produced by Blumhouse, and in conjunction with Universal, I believe they had the distribution rights. And that was made for about $4.5 million and grossed $193 million. So this is good for Jordan Peele. Fantastic. And it's
a little
great
more
because,
fan for it.
Exactly. It's a great thing for Jordan Peele because it's a fantastic film. And he is, I believe, the first black writer and director to break that $100 million mark. And so to get that first look deal, that's crazy. For him coming from comedy, and now he's doing horror. The next film he's doing, he's decided, is going to be another quote-unquote social horror, mm-hmm. similar to Get Out. And for Universal's looking for the money.
Right.
When you have that kind of $193 million over a $4.5 million budget, even if you want to double that budget to include the marketing, usually what you would do is take the budget of the film and double it. That's the cost of making the film, and then the marketing and
the
advertising. That's what they need. So even with $9 million, $9 million movie with marketing and $193 million back, it would be stupid for them not to try and lock him down.
And I don't think it's left theaters yet. It's still going.
No, it is still playing in theaters. It has left most, but you can still find some theaters that are showing Get Out. So that just speaks to the power of that. So, you know.
But for those of you who are familiar with Jordan Peele, I mean, I heard about him from Key & Peele, the sketch comedy show.
And then before that, Mad TV.
Mad TV, of course. But
so now he's a big-time director.
In horror.
So congratulations to Jordan Peele. Just to give you a sense of what he's going from, Blumhouse, who produced Get Out, they are known for doing these kind of lower budget, I would say low to mid-range budget films. They're famous for usually doing horror, and just giving you a sense of what they were doing and what he could be moving up from. So Get Out was $4.5 million budget. The first really big success for Blumhouse was Paranormal Activity. That was made for $15,000 and also grossed $193 million.
Oh, wow.
So
that's their number.
Insidious, another horror film, $1.5 million budget, $97 million take at the box office. The Purge, $3 million, with slightly less of a take, but $89 million at the box. And recently, M. Night Shyamalan's Split, $9 million budget, up at that top of their general ceiling of base budget,
sure.
No marketing included on that one. And that made $275 million.
There we go.
So imagine he's doing a $4.5 million budget and making $193 million. He's going to be getting a lot more money from Universal. But do you think he'll stay with this kind of lower budget and just try to see those high returns?
I hope so. It does sound like this social horror that he's going to be going for again. It's kind of following in. It's not necessarily going to be a sequel to Get Out. I'm sure
no.
It won't be. But it is sort of like how Quentin Tarantino did Inglourious Basterds and then moved on to Django Unchained and then The Hateful Eight.
Yeah.
It's that sort of, you know, it's that sort of a. It's not a sequel.
It's motifs.
Yeah.
You want to call it, maybe?
Yeah, a sequel of motif.
Yeah,
sure. I like that.
Yeah, because they're all these.
Nice.
They're like historical revenge films.
Exactly.
So again, good luck to Jordan Peele. We absolutely loved Get Out. Come on the show,
Jordan. Jordan,
are you there? Come on, Jordan.
We lost. We lost him.
Oh, no, he's not there. All right. All right, but come on the Joe Jordan.
Come on the Joe Jordan show. Come on Cinema.
Come on the show, Jordan. We'd love to talk to you a little bit about it. Finally, you've got an interesting tidbit of news from India. This is coming out of the Bollywood scene. Fantastic film was being made in India for a long time. It's, you know, it's a great place for cinema, but we've finally got the highest grossing film in India recently came out.
Yeah, Bahubali 2. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right.
And we apologize. We're doing the best we can.
But yes, the film was released in India, obviously, released in four different languages, and it grossed a total of $180 million so far. So
wow.
Clearly this is a continuation of a obviously it's a sequel. So the
right.
fact that it's the most successful of all time is very interesting that
exactly.
it's a sequel, but this comes following the prequel to it. the first
yeah,
made $100 million, and so obviously there's a little bit of an improvement here, but it's just interesting to see that, you know, let's not forget that Hollywood isn't the only place that's making movies,
right. And something interesting here from this story, and this is in Variety, in North America, the film collected $13.1 million, which is, I mean, you know, compared to it's going to be in its home country. That's where it's going to do best. And then wherever, you know, you said it was in four different languages.
Mm-hmm.
So wherever those languages are originally spoken, but $13.1 million in North America. So that means there is an audience here. And, you know, there's communities here that are from India or speak the languages that this film was translated into that, you know, maybe want to see some more stuff from Bollywood crossing over to the United States.
Yeah, let's get a little bit more of an inclusive market going here.
Exactly, because Hollywood is, you know, no longer the top dog necessarily of films. We're seeing a lot more gains in China.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, India, the Bollywood scene has been going on for a long time and has always been very well respected and very well loved in its home country and abroad. So maybe we get some more stuff from India coming here, getting translated, and who knows, we could see a total Bollywood revolution again in the United States.
The common theme that is really inspiring to both Tom and I think, is that it's voices that need to be heard that just don't get the opportunity to be heard.
Right.
So congratulations to Bahubali 2, and we hope to see some more films from our friends in India.
Exactly. And India, come on the show.
India? Wait, are you there?
Are you there? We'll get them next time.
We'll get them next time.
All right. Next up, we are going to be having our feature presentation segment. Speaking of voices that need to be heard, it's John Davies, and he runs a group, a screening series. It's many things, but altogether, it's a community called Cinema Obscura, and that's an S in cinema, Sin, as in Sin City. He does weekly screenings at Township here in Chicago, focusing on bringing filmmakers in the city a place to show their films and connect and have a community. We're going to be talking to him about what that's all about, his background in film, and so much more here on No Coast Cinema. Are you ready, Connor?
I think so.
All right. We'll be back in just a bit. No Coast Cinema here on WGN+. Back, everybody. You are listening to No Coast Cinema here on WGN+. WGN+'s premier films podcast. We're talking about films here in Chicago, the business of films, films all around the world, all that good stuff. I'm your host, Tom Hush, and joining me is my co-host, Connor Cornelius.
Great to be back.
We are getting into our feature presentation segment. This is where we talk to people who are big in the Chicago films community, people who are up and coming in the films community here in Chicago, and we want to share with you a little bit about what they do and how they're changing the face of cinema here in the city. Our guest today is John Davies. He is from Cinema Obscura. He is actually the creator. This is his brainchild. They're a Chicago-based group where today's hottest filmmakers can meet, share ideas, and work together. They're dedicated to helping up-and-coming filmmakers share their passion with the public in various local venues, and their mission is to usher in a new era of Chicago cinema. Welcome to the program, John Davies. How are you doing today, John?
Oh, Tom, thank you very much. Connor, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate being here.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you so much for joining us. We're really excited to have you here talking a little bit about what you do with Cinema Obscura. If you could actually talk a little bit about what Cinema Obscura is. I know we got a little description there, but in your own words, what is Cinema Obscura?
Let's say it's basically a movie club that I decided to put together after living here in the city, loving these movies. You don't really get to see them too many places. Just want to get them all under one roof, all together. And like the statement says, just get these directors to know each other. I don't really know that there's any place for them to meet and come together. I wanted to be that place.
That's fantastic. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got interested in film? You know, you create Cinema Obscura, but let's go back to the beginning a little bit. What about film interested you initially?
The biggest thing for me is the escape, getting away, you know, seeing something, being somewhere that I haven't been. You can do it with a book. I appreciate doing it with a book.
Yeah.
But knock everything out in an hour and a half. You can't really beat a movie, honestly.
Yeah, it's pure escapism in 90 minutes or more.
Mm. Was there a specific movie that you first watched when you were, you know, in your childhood or anything that really struck you as, you know, the escapist film that you were, that, you know, got you into it?
I'd say Tom and I were talking a little bit about this before we started, and I'd say the very first Alien movie really got me into it.
Wow, yeah.
You know, that's basically a slasher film in the sci-fi genre, and I'm blown away by that one. Every time I see it, I love it.
Yeah.
And I saw that one when I was, I don't even know, 12. I was a child when I saw it.
Oh, wow.
Just absolutely fell in love with it, loved the nightmares that I got from it, continue to love the nightmares that I get from it, and
yeah.
I just love it, yeah.
Yeah, that's a heavy movie for a 12-year-old to watch.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of things wrapped up in one.
Yeah, I remember watching that one during a 4th of July celebration, and I chose to watch that over fireworks. And I don't know if you've been 12, but fireworks are a pretty big deal when you're a 12-year-old kid. I skipped it for Alien.
Yeah. So would you say that that horror sci-fi is really your entrance into the film world?
Absolutely, yeah.
With the Obscura part of it, you're showing films that really not a lot of people have seen.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And what has been the community response so far? When people come to Cinema Obscura, what's the reaction they have to seeing these films that they probably didn't even know existed?
I'm hoping they love it, to be honest with you. I really do. They keep coming back, so that's a good sign.
Oh, yeah. What's usually the size of the audience when they come?
A good night, we'll get 35, 40 people. Slow night, it'll be 5, you know. And honestly, any more than just myself and my quote-unquote co-workers that show up for these shows, I'm happy.
Sure.
Two of you people want to show up, I'm happy.
Well, hopefully we'll be able to attend one of those. You have them pretty regularly, right?
Every Monday right now at Township.
At Township,
here,
yeah.
Here on California and Chicago.
All right.
Yeah.
What does Township think of the whole thing?
They love it. They love it. I had a friend of mine, Eli Caterer, who got me in with Steve. And, you know, it's just been nothing but good for both sides. You know, they have something going on Monday nights. When they do have a show or they need something that they need the room for, they can kick me out. And that's been, you know, a part of it from the beginning. It is their place. And I just want to get my foot in the door and do this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are there particular directors or films that have come through Cinema Obscura that you felt were particularly unique, or you thought that, you know, how have people not seen this, or do you believe that they might go somewhere else with it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. One of my biggest fans, I guess, would be Mark Wilkinson, who's done quite a few different movies. He's working with Suburban Skies production company. pretty solid here in the city. Love that dude, Jake Wiseman, who brought me to you.
Right, and he was actually a guest on our very first episode.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they were showing Scrapers, mm-hmm. and that's kind of it's a stoner comedy, you know, pretty light. And you also, there was a double feature with Stony Island.
Stony Island, which I had not seen before. It's a fantastic film.
Fantastic. But those were kind of more on the lighter end. I guess they weren't horror or anything. They were not necessarily genre films.
Yeah.
Is there like a type of film that you look for when you're booking these guys, or do you want to look for...
Anything that's centered around Chicago, shot in Chicago, has a production crew member from Chicago, anything. As long as it's semi-Chicago related, I want it for Cinema Obscura.
It's all about getting that voice heard.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, share it with, and it's like we said in the beginning, just sharing it with the other directors and the other people in the industry here in the city and get you guys to know each other, really.
How did you get Cinema Obscura started?
Good question.
Yeah, when did it start?
Yeah.
It was about April last year. Within days of each other, Emily Esperanza of the Wretched Nobles and John Zacharopoulos of HQ, which is a like a loft space just up the street from Odd Obsession Movies Video Store here in Chicago. Within days of each other, they both walked into the store and said, "Do you want to do a movie thing?" And it just like fell into itself from there, I guess.
What made you decide on Township as the venue? Were they just open to it, or was there something particular about it you liked?
I have always been aware of that place. I knew about their side room, their venue room. I knew that would be perfect. I happen to have a friend that worked there and just put in a good word for me, and you know, we just ran from there. You know, myself and Steve Siegel from Township just mm-hmm. started this thing, and you know, I can't thank like Eli enough. He introduced us and brought me into this place. I am still looking for other venues, mm-hmm. a couple in the works, but Township is our main thing here at like every Monday night, aside from, you know, when they need it and holidays and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. So with showing these films in Township, it's a non-traditional way to watch a movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think
absolutely
we can say that. Mm-hmm. What is the experience like watching a film at Township in this non-traditional setting versus the experience you're going to get in a typical theater or a movie mm-hmm. palace?
I would say it's literally right in between watching it on your couch and going to the movies. 'Cause you can just sit there. You can play with your phone. You can be distracted. You can do whatever you want. You can order a burger and fries from the dudes at Township. You can have a beer. But it's not as serious as if you were to go to a movie theater.
Right.
And it's not as, I guess, homey if you were to just stay at home and watch a movie. You're still hanging out with a bunch of people. You're going to meet some people you never met. Mm-hmm. You're going to meet me, maybe.
Yeah.
It's the bar-going experience for people who like to watch movies.
Exactly. Yeah. Get you out of the house and come see some cool stuff.
Do you think this is maybe a way for movies to be, especially on these smaller scale films, the indie films, is this a way for them to get shown instead of going the typical route of trying to get distribution and trying to do this, that, and the next thing? Is Cinema Obscura or anything like it, do you think this is the way going forward?
I truly hope so. You know, building a fan base is probably the first thing you should be thinking about when you're making a movie. Not necessarily selling it to a studio, not necessarily, you know, making money off of it, but getting people to like your product and like what you do, you know, so that you can continue to do it and do it again and again and again. You know, you can make one amazing movie, sell it off and never do anything again. That's okay, I suppose, but you need a starting point. You know, we're hopefully a little bit of a starting point. You know, we're not going to necessarily get you into the film festivals, not necessarily going to get you into the music box, but we will get you a fan base. I can pretty much guarantee you that.
I mean, at the very least, it would be just a fun thing to do on an evening, right?
Exactly.
And you're not going in there, you're not getting any of that price hikes that you get if you go to a movie palace or a mm-mm. theater. Mm-mm. You're just going in, you're going to a bar, and then you're watching a few Absolutely. Movies that were made by people who...
Yeah, and I can't stress enough, the movies, the screenings, everything they do is 100% free. So just show up,
yeah,
watch something, laugh, cry, leave.
Feel something.
Blog about it. Tell your friends about it.
Feel something, people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So with the filmmakers that you've had come in, what's the feeling you get from them when this could possibly be their first screening of this film?
Mostly appreciation, honestly. A lot of appreciation from these guys and ladies. It's, you know, I started this to help them out, but they're helping me get to know them and their community more than I could ever have imagined. I had very little idea what I was going to be doing with this when I started it. And all the positive reaction from all these guys, and it's just unbelievable. It's so much fun.
That's fantastic. I mean, it's the whole what we said about just getting the film shown, mm-hmm. and getting your very first film seen by a group of people. Last episode we talked with Nate Waters and from Into the Void Films, and he said that the experience of hearing someone react to your film, mm-hmm. and just at least showing it, positive or negative reaction, it helps you grow as a filmmaker. Do you see Cinema Obscura as helping these filmmakers grow?
I hope so. I hope they're all these directors are having in mind the ability to play their movie in my little venue or wherever I'm doing it, wherever right. we're doing it. You know, I don't want to take any credit for anything that they're doing. They're doing what they're doing because they want to do it. I'm just here to help them get a little bit of a following.
What's it like planning this with Township? You know, is it stressful to find films, or are the films just raining down from the sky?
They're not raining. I'm definitely looking for, you know, applicants all the mm-hmm. time. There's a lot of stuff that I've had to go for. Luckily, it's only a once a week thing.
Right.
Some of them are very easy, where it's just a feature-length film created by somebody here local, and then they're going to pick a movie that inspired them to make that movie, or just something that they want to share with everybody. Mm-hmm. And that's an easy double feature. The ones where I do have to do a little work are the TV party nights, and that's where I have, you know, a dozen to 15 different directors with a bunch of different shorts, all under one roof, all getting watched by a whole bunch of different people. Those ones take some time. Those ones take a lot of work to get going.
And where can people apply to get their film shown with Cinema Obscura?
Just send me a DM on the Facebook, and you know, I'll send you my address via the email. You can send me your links, whatever you got, and share.
All right, excellent. And that's Cinema Obscura with an S for cinema. Cinema. I love it. We're going to be right back in just a moment with John Davies from Cinema Obscura. He's the creator. This is his brainchild, this group, this weekly series of films. Next, we're going to be talking a little bit about some bigger questions, the modern film industry, what it's doing right, what it's doing wrong, and how Chicago as a community can be a beacon for filmmakers. This is No Coast Cinema here on WGN Plus. I'm your host, Tom Hush, joined by my co-host, Connor Cornelius, and our guest right now is John Davies. We'll be right back in just a moment. All right, back again with No Coast Cinema here on WGN Plus. I'm your host, Tom Hush, joined by my co-host, Connor Cornelius. And our guest right now is John Davies from Cinema Obscura. It is a group. It is a screening series. It is a whole lot of things dealing with film here in Chicago. They're helping filmmakers here and film fans here come together and usher in a new era for Chicago cinema. Thanks again for joining us, John. We really appreciate it.
I really appreciate you guys. Thank you.
All right. What I want to get into for this portion is a little bit bigger questions, stuff about the film industry and how it compares to Chicago. So let's start with the modern film industry. How do you feel about it? As someone who is an appreciator of film, someone who goes to the movies, mm-hmm. what do you think about the way movies are made and how they're released here in 2017?
Well, I think we live in a really good time right now for movies. You know, a lot of CGI coming out, a lot of stuff they can do with computers, a lot of stuff they don't need to do with the computers.
Right. We talked a little bit about the film The Void off the air.
Yes.
And that's something that uses a lot of practical effects.
Absolutely.
And you're a big fan of practical effects, correct?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, they last. They tend to hold up through the years.
Sure.
You know, you can go back and watch Stephen King's The Mist, look at the CGI in that, look at Lawnmower Man from even further back. It just doesn't hold up.
No.
The miniatures from Star Wars hold up. The practical effects from The Void will hold up forever. Mm-hmm. And that it's just mind-blowing that those guys spent the money and took the time to do all that work for that movie in particular, The Void. And I just... Thank you, Astron Set.
Yeah. So I guess that's where some of the big money that you get in the, you know, in what most people think of when they think of the film industry. That's one of the positives probably that are coming along with that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But we do also know that Hollywood is, on average, making less movies. And this came out of the WGA, the Writers Guild Association, kind of talks that they had recently. One of the issues they had was that Hollywood's not making a lot of movies anymore. They're making bigger movies. Yeah. We're seeing, you know, these massive tent poles, like, you know, the Transformers series is still unbelievably going on. Mm-hmm. We've got Star Wars that could go on into infinity. But these smaller budget films are kind of disappearing a little bit. Do you feel that's a bad thing, you know, less choice? Or maybe we should be spending more money on bigger tent poles?
No, I don't. I think we need to revert back to the originals of cinema. Get the small people up there. Get the small budget movies up there. You know, we don't need Guardians of the Galaxy for the rest of our lives. No. We really don't. You know, we need some substance here and there. We don't need explosions constantly.
And if there's anything more that could be sort of a poster child for that, I mean, Get Out was made on a $4 million budget, mm-hmm. and we saw the returns that it got on that.
Yeah.
Astronomical.
Yeah.
Nobody saw that coming.
Mind-blowing successful.
Yeah.
Mind-blowing.
So let's looking at Get Out and looking at Blumhouse Productions. They seem to be a studio that is keeping the mid-budget movie alive, mm-hmm. more or less. Most of their films sit somewhere between that $5 to $10 million mark. And they're seeing great returns. They're seeing not only, you know, financial success, but we're seeing critical success with most of it. I mean, the Insidious films are not exactly well beloved by critics, but they're serviceable in terms of horror.
Yeah.
So is that the way we go forward?
I don't know. I don't know what they're going to do going forward.
Tell us, John.
If they could get more original content and knock it off with the remakes, I think most of us would be happy.
Seriously.
You know, we'd just enough with the remakes. Already.
Enough with the remakes. Yeah. Well, and since Cinema Obscura is, you know, showing smaller films that are, you know, more original, mm-hmm. They can't draw on these massive franchises. No one's coming into Cinema Obscura with their version of Star Wars Rogue One. Do you think that these films you're showing show the promise of maybe getting into that mid-range budget? Could these directors
Absolutely. These are all small budget movies that are made by people with real jobs, and this is just something they do on the side, and they're fantastic. A lot of these movies are just great. Seriously.
And you know, if someone is, you know, maybe a more casual movie viewer, they're going to see these big budget films. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
What would they see? Pretty much the same level of quality in these smaller, you know, personal films that you're showing at Cinema Obscura versus the big tentpole. Do you need the money to capture the casual viewer?
I don't think you do. I really don't think you do. You know, if you make a product good enough, and there's like I was saying, if there's substance to it, people will want it. You know, if they're not just looking for, you know, famous people and makeup and CGI effects and cool explosions. Mm-hmm. There are people out there that do want substance. I know they are out there. And a lot of these people are making these movies. So I need these people to get together and to know each other. And yeah, absolutely.
Get them all in a room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to your point, I recently watched Scrapers, which was written and directed by a friend, Jake Wiseman, who I believe we all know. Mm-hmm. And kind of to your point about how when you are watching something with of quality, that shines through, right?
Exactly.
And even though Scrapers is very obviously a lower budget film, mm-hmm. the cleverness really shines through, and you are definitely struck by the sense that the person that's writing this definitely had a vision in mind.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, it's just a it's a fun thing to watch.
It's a fun movie, and it's got heart. It's got a lot of heart. I don't know why people don't want heart anymore, but I personally do, and I know a handful of people that do, and those are the people that I'm going to hug all the time and every day.
There you go.
So, yeah.
That's what Cinema Obscura is all about. It's all about hugging and heart.
That's right.
I love it.
Spreading love.
With the film industry, we've talked about some things that it could be doing better. We'll call it wrong. They're making some mistakes here. They're doing too few films mm-hmm. that are too high budget, and it's cutting out essentially what I would call the middle class of film. Is there anything that you think they're doing right? Is Hollywood getting anything correct?
I don't know. I'm torn because there is a lot of technology that we have now that will make these films better. Mm-hmm. I'm going to keep going back to The Mist because that movie, the atmosphere in that movie, the heart of that movie is amazing, but the special effects are laughable. They're not good.
I feel like The Mist, and that's personally a movie I really enjoyed mm-hmm. when I saw it. I was, you know, I'm a fan of Frank Darabont, and mm-hmm. I think he's pretty much adapted Stephen King better than most in terms of, you know, Stephen King, I don't think outright hates The Mist, unlike The Shining. That movie is almost a case study in having a really good story and mm-hmm. making a film with intention and with understanding and having great characters and everything. But the effects of the day, you know, what he was forced to use, they were just like, well, we can't do the practical mm-hmm. stuff. We got to use some CGI. It shows where CGI can fall short, but I feel like with The Mist, it's still the characters and the rest of the film makes up for that.
Exactly.
Sure, yeah.
Exactly.
Because when you see those giant creatures walking around, yeah, they don't look great. Mm-hmm. You know, it could be better, but honestly, when I watch it again, I just don't care.
Yeah.
I'm just like, I'm so engrossed in the story.
I 100% agree, and I feel that Hollywood has traded that. They would rather give you the pretty tentacles and the pretty CGI and save money on the acting and the heart and the atmosphere and the rest of it.
Which is totally...
It'll look nice, but it won't feel nice.
And it's totally ironic considering what you said, that these practical effects, they age so much better. You go back and watch Jaws, mm-hmm. yeah, it's very obviously a fake shark, but it looks a hell of a lot better than, you know, Deep Blue Sea.
Oh, God.
Where it's these CGI sharks just popping out and eating Sam
Poor
Jackson.
Sam-O.
Oh, man.
Give me
a shark that barely works and it still gives you an incredible film mm-hmm. that ages great because you have the acting, you have the story, you have the direction.
Exactly.
It's all there.
Exactly.
It's all there. Hollywood's got a lot to work on. They could stand to look at their own history and maybe learn something about it. Now, comparing it to Chicago, we've compared it a little bit to what people are doing in Chicago, these low-budget things. Why is Chicago, in your opinion, a fertile place for the filmmaker?
We're in the Midwest, baby. We're the heart of this country. Everybody knows that California and New York are dying.
Mm-hmm.
Is that safe to say?
They're eating themselves.
Yeah. They're destroying themselves. Chicago's where it is. Dick Wolf knows. Everybody else should know.
Yeah.
Follow Dick Wolf.
Yeah. How many series has he launched about the Chicago municipal, like,
I believe
services?
There's 27 or 28 different series.
Oh, God. Chicago Fire Part 2.
CTA.
The Fire. Yeah. could we see that? I would
love to see a CTA.
Yeah.
Come on, Dick.
That could be
my God.
Yeah.
I had a flash of what that would look like.
Yeah. Cinema Obscura presents Chicago CTA.
Conductors, bussing heads all the way up the L.
Yeah. The bus drivers are the stars of the city. They should
honestly.
Seriously. Absolutely.
But you make a point. Chicago over, you know, the last few years has really evolved in a place where people are coming to make films. Mm-hmm. If we want to look back at the Dark Knight series, up to Dark Knight Rises, which I think they changed to New York, or they they did less in Chicago.
Philadelphia or something?
Yeah, a different city. But you watch Batman Begins and The Dark Knight, two really great big-budget superhero movies. Yep. They were here in Chicago. Yep. Every time you're on Lower Wacker, you know, you can look over and be like, hey, this is where this chase scene took place.
We are forever Gotham City.
Forever.
Honestly. And Transformers as well. Done a lot of filming here. The number of TV series filming here now. Are we becoming the new place to go?
I hope so. I really do. A lot of talented people in this city, and they need the work, to be honest with you.
That's true. That's absolutely. It opens up so many jobs. You got extras, people on the crew, all that, and we can finally see some stars or something like that.
Exactly.
I know Joe Swanberg, who is, I don't know, I don't think he's originally from Chicago, but he's very much established himself as a Chicago filmmaker. He did Drinking Buddies, which I believe was filmed here in Chicago, and he recently did a series called Easy for Netflix. He did the film Win It All, which was for Netflix. I mean, he's filming in Rogers Park, where no one is filming. So, you know, maybe Cinema Obscura will have the next big Netflix star showing soon.
That would be nice. I mean, honestly, I'd like Chicago to stay under the radar for a little while longer.
That's true.
We don't need everybody from Hollywood here. We don't need everybody from New York here. But, you know, what we do have here is working, and we're just going to keep running with it.
That's fantastic. So Chicago is a thriving place. It's, you know, there's a lot of filmmakers here, a lot of people doing some really cool stuff. Do you have any plans to expand Cinema Obscura? I know that you mentioned maybe doing some venues outside of Township, moving it around a little bit. What are your plans for the future?
I would love to take this not only from venue to venue here in Chicago, but other places in the country. I would love to do this. There's another, you know, group of people out there that are doing some shorts, doing some crazy stuff that just doesn't have an audience for it. Put something like Cinema Obscura together and do it.
Have
like
a few different chapters.
Yeah, something like a tour even maybe.
Yeah.
Get out there and, you know, have you ever thought about going out to maybe like the suburbs or anything like that, trying to find the audience?
I don't really want to be that mobile just yet.
It sounds
if
tough.
I'm going outside of Chicago, I'm going to go way outside of Chicago.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I'm going to
take to these big tentpole cities.
Go to the cities that I just dissed on.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, they've got, you know, it reminds me a little bit of something like Second City. You know, there's a Second City up in like Toronto. There's a you know, there's people from Second City that went on to start their own groups in you know, in New York and LA. So maybe Cinema Obscura, that's the next thing as you move to these bigger cities. If you want to head to their Facebook, it's Cinema Obscura, and that's an S in cinema. So definitely check them out on Facebook. Find all these updates. You're going to get them there. And if you want to see some more from John Davies on social media, he also runs the social media for Odd Obsession Movies. Great Instagram page.
Thank you.
Tons of fun stuff. Thank you again so much, John Davies.
I really appreciate you guys letting me come on and talk about my stuff, Connor and Tom.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
We really appreciate coming on, and we will see you at Township. We will see you at the movies.
Thank you. Cheers.
All right. We're going to be back in a little bit on No Coast Cinema. We're going to be doing a small retrospective on the recently deceased director, Jonathan Demme. Stick around.
Once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
Oh boy, that is Anthony Hopkins as Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs.
Cue theremin.
Cue the theremin. You are listening to No Coast Cinema here on WGN Plus, WGN Plus's premier films podcast. We're covering films all around the world, but mostly in Chicago, but also talking about the business of films and just the art of making films as well. And when it comes to making films as art, there's perhaps very few directors as talented and as accomplished as the recently deceased director Jonathan Demme. Jonathan Demme directed Silence of the Lambs. He did the Talking Heads concert film Stop Making Sense. He also did Philadelphia, starring Tom Hanks and Denzel Washington, and so much more. And he recently passed away very, very sudden. It felt very sudden because, you know, were we hearing a lot of health updates from Jonathan Demme? Not really.
No.
So
who knew that he was struggling with esophageal cancer?
Exactly. Passed away from esophageal cancer.
April 26th.
April 26th. Believe age 75 years old. He was relatively young.
Yeah.
I believe in his 70s, passed away from esophageal cancer. So we just wanted to do a quick little retrospective here in our post-credit sequence, looking back at some of the big films that Jonathan Demme directed.
It's really a fascinating career.
Truly, truly, because, you know, he was really not massive in the industry.
Started in the early 80s working on, you know, smaller budget comedy films.
Exactly. Started back then, and he was really growing from there. And his big break was obviously Silence of the Lambs with Anthony Hopkins and Jodie Foster as Clarice Starling. And that was one of the few horror movies that made it to the Academy Awards. And it is a horror movie. Some people have argued against that, but it is a horror movie. It, you know, everybody knows the story. Hannibal the Cannibal, Buffalo Bill, Clarice Starling. They can quote it a million times. And it's such a mature film as well in terms of the filmmaking experience.
Absolutely.
When you watch that, it is the eye of someone who really knows what they're doing. He made that film in his mid-40s. And when you look at it, it is just an incredible work of not just horror, not just thriller, whatever you want to call it, but just film. He had an incredible way of looking at the characters in the frame. If we can all collectively remember that scene with Anthony Hopkins, when any scene really, when Clarice Starling is talking to Hannibal Lecter, he's got these amazing views of their faces. And he's using these wide-angle lenses that really give you, it makes their face seem really big.
It inhabited the psychological element of that movie.
Yeah, and you're looking directly into their eyes.
Which is kind of why I feel like the Academy probably let it go as far as it did. It won Best Picture,
yes.
Best Director, I believe, at least was nominated, Best Actress.
Yeah, and Anthony Hopkins got an Oscar for his performance as Hannibal Lecter. And Jonathan Demme is always going to be associated with that film. There's no question about it. That's going to be the one that really stands out to people. But he has had a fairly long career. As I said, he made Silence of the Lambs when he was in his mid-40s. But another film that came out after Silence of the Lambs was Philadelphia. And that was another critically acclaimed film. Tom Hanks and Denzel Washington, as I said before. I'm just going to play a little clip here from early on in the film when Denzel and Tom Hanks are talking to each other. If you don't know the premise of the film, it's about a lawyer who is fired from his job. And he believes that he was wrongfully terminated because he is a gay man with AIDS. And he takes this case in this scene to Denzel Washington. And Denzel doesn't really know what to make of the whole thing.
All right, explain this to me like I'm a two-year-old, okay? Because there's an element to this thing I just cannot get through my thick head. Didn't you have an obligation to tell your employer you had this dreaded, deadly, infectious disease?
That's not the point. From the day they hired me to the day I was fired, I served my clients consistently, thoroughly, with absolute excellence. If they hadn't fired me, that's what I'd be doing today.
And they don't want to fire you for having AIDS, so in spite of your brilliance, they'd make you look incompetent, thus the mysterious lost file. Is that what you're trying to tell me?
Correct. I was sabotaged.
I don't buy it, counselor.
That's very disappointing.
I don't see a case.
I have a case. If you don't want it for personal reasons.
Thank you. That's correct. I don't.
Powerful. Great performances from Tom Hanks and also from Denzel Washington. But that movie came out in a time when I felt like it was really important to be talking about the AIDS crisis. And Jonathan Demme handled it in such a beautiful, artful way. There's another scene that I call just the opera scene where Tom Hanks' character is listening to an opera, and it becomes almost dream. It starts out normal. He's listening to the opera, and then you kind of get into the head of the character, and the camera is coming around, and the lighting changes to all red, and he starts talking about how he's become like death and all this kind of stuff, and he's conquering his death. And I just don't know if any other director could have handled the subject and handle it in such a cinematic way.
Yeah, again, it's just a great example of him being able to take what you're filming is just the outward facade, but really breaking through to that psychological element, which is so important in a movie like Philadelphia, or even like Silence of the Lambs.
Exactly. And finally, I want to talk just really quickly about, I'll kind of mash them together, two films. One of them is called Swimming to Cambodia, and that is starring Spalding Gray, and that's a film version of one of his famous long monologues of his one-man performance of Swimming to Cambodia. And also the film Stop Making Sense, which is the concert film to end all concert films, starring the Talking Heads. It is looked to as the template of how to do a concert film.
While it was breaking it at the same time.
Exactly. He was taking concert films to a new level and creating a new way to look at capturing live performance. And the same thing goes for Spalding Gray, because capturing a live theater performance is super difficult to really get it right. You can't just stick the camera in front of the stage and call it. You have to capture the whole performance. And similar to what he would do in Silence of the Lambs and what he would do in Philadelphia, he's really good at getting the character. He's really good at showing the performance of the whole thing. And that's why Swimming to Cambodia is so great. And he does the same thing in Stop Making Sense. He captures the energy of the Talking Heads. Now, granted, a lot of what's happening on stage is partially the Talking Heads, especially the stuff with the big suit that that David Byrne's wearing, and everything that's happening up there is partially Talking Heads, but it shows a man who really understood his subjects and how to capture the performance of his subjects, whether or not he was actively directing them.
Absolutely. And to your point, I read a great article, an interview from Charlie Libin, who was a longtime camera operator that worked with Demme on many. He actually directed more than just the Stop Making Sense concert film. He directed several from Neil Young, Heart of Gold, Trunk Show, and Journeys. Mm-hmm. And just something that he said about Libin that just makes me feel like I know him a little bit more was that he says he never lost that childlike curiosity from behind the camera. And obviously, he spent his entire life working, towards the film career.
Absolutely.
And it's just nice to hear from somebody that, was a longtime colleague of his, that he just never lost that childlike curiosity.
And I think that's where we'll cap it off for Mr. Jonathan Demme. Again, thank you for the films. And we only covered a couple here, but please look into his work. If you already love Silence of the Lambs, if you already love Stop Making Sense, if you already love Philadelphia, go look into his previous films, because he was a filmmaker for so long, and it would be a shame to, forget all the great things that he did. So That'll be it for us here on No Coast Cinema. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to John Davies from Cinema Obscura for coming on the show. We really appreciate it. We will see you next time. I've been your host, Tom Hush, joined by Connor Cornelius. Thank you again, Connor.
Thank you, Tom.
You're my best friend, but I also hate you.
Yeah, we have some things to work out.
Yeah,
we're so going, tune in next time.
Yeah, tune in next time. We'll be in couples therapy. No Coast Cinema here on WGN+. Good morning, good afternoon, and good night. We're going to play you out with a little bit of music here from the Talking Heads, from Jonathan Demme's fantastic concert film, Stop Making Sense.
Good night. We'll be right back.
sky.